Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Memorial Day. Thanks so much for being with us on Memorial Day. Hope it's a great one where you are in the United States. It's kind of, we get the feeling that summer starts on Memorial Day, ends on Labor Day. I don't know why we do that, but that's how we do it, and I insist upon it. As a matter of fact, if it was up to me, school would end. Well, there's no school this year. I don't know, but I guess I should just end that sentence right there. If it was up to me, school would end. No, yeah, nobody would go to school.
And never come back?
Yeah, right. But I have some negative childhood associations with school.
Oh, you know, Si, God, boy, let's see how many people I can irritate here. I think the worst thing you can do to a boy, especially, is make him sit at a desk for six hours a day.
Yeah,
That's why I like Dan Kerr's school so much and Gregory the Great. They're doing boy things. They're like trapping badgers and
raising cattle.
Yes,
or whatever.
And memorizing poems and learning Latin.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What's going to happen to them? They're going to be healthy and educated boys when they're done.
Yes, exactly. Man, and you know
we
what?
Can't have that.
You know what they're not doing, Si?
Electronics.
They're not looking at screens.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Well, they're better than me then.
Better than I. I thought you were an English major.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
You better hope my mom.
That is all. She'd be really upset with that.
Oh my gosh, she's a linguist. She has a master's in linguistics. She's constantly correcting grammar.
Yeah.
Where do you think I got it from?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like in the age of Twitter, I've given up. I got to stop that. I will elevate. All right. I will elevate the level of the discourse, especially because we are talking about one of the greatest people in human history.
Yes.
As a matter of fact,
Mark Twain says something like that.
I think he said the greatest person in human history.
Yeah, he does in the introduction to his book. I don't know the exact words, but it's something along those lines.
His book, a novel about Joan of Arc, often thought of as his worst novel. He said it was his best novel. Yeah, he loved it.
I know. He is wrong, by the way.
You don't think it's his best novel?
Oh, Huckleberry Finn is in the top five American books, if not top three.
Yeah, it's hard. I guess if you've written Huckleberry Finn, it's kind of hard that any of your other books. I mean, it is the great American novel. I mean,
but can we actually start with Twain here, because it's interesting how that all happened.
Yeah, because he's an anti-Catholic.
He is very derisive. It's not even clear that he's a Christian.
Oh, he's definitely not a Christian. Yeah. I think it's clear that he's not a Christian. He's kind of an H.L. Mencken kind of figure. Not as bitter as Mencken, but
self-loathing Southerner.
Very funny man, you know.
But when Twain was a teenager, what happened? Quichero, or Quicherot, however you say that, the French linguist, anthropologist, archaeologist, historian, goes and gets all of the trial documents and all of the rehabilitation documents from St. Joan's trial and rehabilitation. I don't know how many volumes this is, Si. Is it 20 volumes? And as Twain says in the introduction of his book, translates them into modern, lucid, readable French.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
Twain could read.
Uh-huh.
And he was just overwhelmed with the story.
Can I tell you something? Mark Twain and I had the exact same experience there, but in a different way. Truly, the transcripts of the trial of Joan of Arc.
Well, clearly he wrote a book.
Will convert you. It's different in this way too, because I found him on the internet. But doing one of those things where you probably don't do this, but I'm one of those people who, like, I follow a topic, I go on to another topic, and I'm starting to follow it. My internet practice is like following.
Of course.
If you look back over, you go, why did you keep, so I end up one night late too, the transcripts of the trial of Joan of Arc. And I don't remember even what series of clicks got me there. I started reading the transcripts of the trial, the English translation. I can't read French. The English translation is, very, very easy to read. And as you read the transcripts of the trial itself, I'm not a lawyer. I don't want to read a trial transcript. You become introduced to this person who doesn't leap off the page, is like in the room with you. It's astounding what Joan is. And I've never stopped loving her since stumbling upon these transcripts, which, as you said, were only became available to modern audiences in the 19th century.
Yeah, you and I have a similar affection for her, love of her, Si. She, and as Twain makes the point, there's probably no medieval figure about whom we know so much, because
they examined everything about her.
Well, they did, and all the testimony is given under oath.
Oh, that's a very good point.
It's all given under oath, and it's all corroborated.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and there's two kind of trials. I mean, there's a set, two sets of trials. There's the set of trials.
By the way, we should call them what they were. They were Inquisitions.
Well, but there's the papal trial too, 20 years later, which happens in Paris.
Right.
And that at the papal trial, a great deal of evidence comes out, including from her own family members, some of whom were charlatans, but her mother was a very honorable person.
Right.
And so there's again an accumulation of data about Joan, about from her mother, for example, about how she grew up and all that stuff. So we have lots and lots of information on Joan.
Yeah. And as I say, corroborated by multiple witnesses, all given under oath. It's an amazing story. If somebody wanted to take a look at these, Régine Pernod has a volume called Joan in Her Own Words. And it's a very nice, I think Régine, I don't know that Régine Pernod is still alive, but she really was France's foremost Joan scholar. She has an excellent little book also that Ignatius came out with a number of years ago called Those Terrible Middle Ages.
Yeah.
That sort of busts a lot of Middle Ages myths.
Which needs to happen.
Amen. But Régine Pernod, Joan in Her Own Words.
Oh, and her words are magnificent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know almost where to start, but maybe you could just give us a brief overview of the life of Joan, the very short life of Joan of Arc.
It was, well, brief. I can't do that. Joan comes into history during what's called the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah.
They don't call it that while it's going on.
They didn't know when it was going to end.
Oh, my goodness.
What are we, we're 70, in year 40.
73 years to go. No, that that actually is a name that was given to it in the 19th century. But it was a series of invasions of France by England that I think lasted 106 years, ending in the first half of the 15th century and beginning a century before, for a lot of complicated reasons. And if someone were to get my lecture on St. Joan from Catholic.com, from shop.catholic.com, I go into them in detail. But basically, it is two things at work. One, a war over the secession of the French crown, traced through Isabella, who's the daughter of Philip the Fourth, called Philip the Fair, who's the grandson of St. Louis. And but Isabella marries Edward the Third of England, and Longshanks' son. I hate to do this because the history in this movie is so potted. But if you know Braveheart,
then you know Longshanks.
Then you know Longshanks, Patrick McGoohan, and his son, who's sort of the less than virile fellow, right? Who marries Isabella, the she-wolf of France, who was not, I don't think, as lovely as that actress who plays her in the movie. But in any case, they have a child, Edward III, the Black Prince, who has a claim, he thinks, to the throne of France. And that's what kicks it off. Right. And there's another contested region of France called Aquitaine, which is rich in vineyards. And and I guess the short way to say this, Cy, is the histories of these two countries since the Norman invasion in 1066 are inextricably tangled. French is the language of English court. I mean, these guys aren't Englishmen, they're Normans.
Yeah.
So there's something to the argument of a claim. I actually think it's not a very good one, but nonetheless. But that's how the whole thing gets started. And it's just one series of raids after another that lasts for over 100 years, 106 years. Joan comes in near the end.
But Joan also comes about, she's about 100 years after the Black Plague first hits. So there's been devastation of population in Europe, which is part of what destabilized Europe. But one of the things that, so she's got war and disease she's got to contend with, as everybody does in that part of Europe at the time. But one of the things that I think people don't appreciate is being a medieval girl like Joan was, it's not a matter of, you know, just growing up in mud, you know, like just you sleep with the pigs and stuff. She lives a very middle class life. The church, her church is right next door to her home. You'd recognize it as a middle class life.
Oh, her parents were, I would describe them as sort of successful landowners
yeah.
in the town of Domremy. 1412 is the year of her birth. Yeah. So really actually less than a century from the Black Plague, which is middle of the 14th century.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, she led a very happy life as a child by her testimony.
Right.
And then one day, and a pious girl and the kind to give up her bed to a stranger. So a sense of hospitality in the Christian sense there.
Right.
But then one day there she is praying and she hears voices.
Yeah.
And they tell her that she's going to lead the army to liberate France from the English. And she says, I've never ridden a horse. I mean, I just love it. It's not like...
She's 13, by the way,
yeah,
at the time.
Yes.
She's a 13-year-old French girl from the, you know, east of France.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lorraine, beautiful. And this, and part of her story, of course, is her love of where she's from.
Yes, right. That's right.
Yeah, but
she said, at one point she says, I don't have anything against the English. She does. She won't be hateful towards the English.
No,
she refused.
They should just
I just
go
want
home.
Them to go back to England.
Yeah, where they right exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So she hears the voices that tell her that she's going to lead the army to liberate France, and she's I've never shot a bow. I've never ridden a horse. Do you have the wrong person? It's almost. There's something, Father Thurston, many years later in writing the entry on her in Butler's Lives of Saints, says there's a quality in her like Our Lady. She doesn't get it entirely,
no,
but she says yes anyway.
Right, an age very much like Our Lady
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And later, I got to go to the break, but of course, in the modern era, when you hear 13-year-old girls hearing voices, people go, well, she's a schizophrenic, or she's has frontal lobe epilepsy or
right,
something.
Right.
And the only thing you can say about that is no, that is not what happened to Joan. She is so clearly not a person suffering from any mental illness.
No, she doesn't behave in an erratic way.
No.
She behaves with a sense of purpose.
In every room she's in, she's the most lucid person.
Yes.
Always.
Yes.
There's never a time where Joan is not head of the class as far as clear-headed, understands what's going on,
right,
is communicating better than everyone else.
Yep. No, did you not understand what I said? This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
we're gonna take the Dauphin to Reims and get him crowned.
But the other thing that is said about Joan, and I think maybe Margaret Mead had something to do with this, I can't remember the social scientist who did, is that she was a witch and she was actually part of a persecuted minority sect of witches because the Catholic Church was run by men and it was afraid of feminine power and all that. And sometimes she's lionized by contemporary feminists for that reason. We'll tackle that. Is that what Joan was? When we come back right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
We talk to audiences all over the world. One thing I've found out is everybody in the whole world has the same set of questions. They live the same human life. They all want meaning. They all want love. They all want significance. They want forgiveness. That's the most fascinating thing to me. The same answers work wherever you are throughout the world because we're all children of God.
Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders tonight, 11 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Just a quick disclaimer before we go any farther. All of the French pronunciations in this program will be wrong. So to any of you
bonjour
French teachers are that we're just going to get just accepted.
You know, Si, where I got where I learned how to pronounce French?
What, Pepe Le Pew?
No, Peter Sellers.
Oh, Peter Sellers, the great Peter Sellers, Inspector Clouseau.
Yes, the chimpanzee minky.
We're talking about Joan of Arc this hour. As at a commemoration of Memorial Day, we decided to do the kind of the military side of the Catholic faith. We talked about Catholic military saints the first hour, and Joan of Arc gets a whole hour, in part because Chris and I are both, and this predates our even having met one another.
It's true.
Both people who fell in love at a certain time with Joan of Arc, as I hope you will too. I mean, she really is somebody worth your time and attention. And we're going to get into her geopolitical, global, trans-historical. I mean, she really has a value that you almost cannot overstate the importance of Joan of Arc in world history.
I have a Joan of Arc challenge that I am going to issue after the next break. So you have to hang on at least through the next break. See, I learned that from you, Si.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a radio DJ.
Joan of Arc challenge coming up
after the next break. Yeah.
Okay, but we said before, after the break, we would talk about Joan as a witch. A modern kind of telling of Joan makes her slightly queer because she's a cross-dresser, and makes her dangerous because she has this secret pagan, feminist, earthy, magical knowledge that the Catholic Church wanted to suppress. And that's what Joan really was, and the Catholic Church hid it. By the way, this completely flies in the face of the fact that they had libraries, they kept records. Like, none of this relates at all to anything that Joan actually did. But
no, most of the myths about Joan, like the witch one or the feminist one or the proto-Protestant one, they all come much, much later.
Yeah.
But there were no witch trials in France and Spain and Catholic countries. Do you know, because of the Inquisition?
Well, I thought the Catholic Church spent the entire Middle Ages burning scientists and witches. You're saying that is not the case.
Nope, that is true. There were some heretics who did get burned.
Yeah, not a single scientist in the entire medieval period ever
burned by
the church.
Yeah, do you know who the father of modern chemistry was burned? I'm trying to remember his name right now. Was beheaded by the guillotine during the Terror.
Yeah, right.
So it was the anti-Christian government that killed the scientists.
Medieval Christians were Catholic Christians. Well, all Christians were Catholic at the time. Medieval Catholic Christians were
the witch trials took place in Protestant countries, which by the way come after St. Joan anyway.
But what I want to get to is this society that Joan grew up in was a very enlightened, educated, very curious and predominantly just society. They were very concerned with justice.
Yes.
So Joan is prosperous, you know, not prosperous in the sense of like her family lived in a castle, but middle class prosperous,
sure.
You know, doing fine type of family, grows up next to the church, shows great piety, as her mother testified later, as a child, but not piety like, you know, people weren't ready to canonize her as a 10-year-old. She's not.
She was a normal 10-year-old girl.
Yeah. But at 13, she begins to have auditory and visual encounters with
St. Michael the Archangel.
St. Michael first.
Catherine of Alexandria, I think.
And Margaret. Which Margaret is it? Well, is the early Margaret. But
Maybe it's Margaret of Alexandria. Or
St. Margaret of.
It's not Margaret of Hungary.
No. But it's St. Margaret and Catherine, both women who had been martyred because they had refused the advances of men during the Roman Empire.
Yes.
Catherine, of course, the patron saint here.
Of apologists.
Because she's the patron of apologists, along with a couple other folks. Catherine herself, like Joan, I believe, and maybe Margaret too, but Catherine reputed to have been a genius. You couldn't best Catherine in a debate. Joan, I think personally, is a natural genius. In addition to being a person of great supernatural gifts, I think she's a natural genius.
And she demonstrates now where it came from.
Who knows?
She demonstrates a genius for military tactics, and this is testified to by the commanders who served with her during her trial.
Well, the other thing about reading the trial transcript in the middle of the night, as I did, is Joan jumps off the page as smarter than everybody else.
Right.
Like you don't get the sense that poor Joan. She can't keep up with these great theologians. She comes across as smarter than they are.
Well,
her answers are more are simpler and more direct than their convoluted questions, but they never ever get the best of her.
There's that great moment near the beginning of the story where after she makes her way secretly to Charles, the Dauphin or Crown Prince, who's cowering in Chinon, And he hears that she's on the way, so he disguises himself in the room. And Joan's not having any of this.
No, she walks right up to him.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah.
Why are you wasting my time? Let's come on. Let's get the army going.
Stop the games.
Yeah.
Right. I don't treat me like a child. And she is in many ways.
Well, she's 17 at this point, right?
Yeah. She's so young.
And she's already had to talk Robert Badricourt. She's had to talk several people into her mission, but she convinces them all.
And she has these visions of St. Michael, and she has two friends. Really, Margaret and Catherine are her friends. You get the sense in her life that, I don't know if daily would be correct, but very, very frequently she's having conversations with these two women saints. I myself look at the story of Joan, Catherine, and Margaret as something very gentlemanly in regard to Christ, in that he sends this poor, I mean, not poor in monetary sense, but who's going to suffer a great deal, Joan, feminine companionship of these great martyr saints, women who went through exactly what she's going to have to go through, assaults on her chastity constantly, assaults on her person constantly. And he doesn't, this is my understanding of it as a Christian, that Christ is, he's not asking this young girl like to go and live with men in this very masculine, very dangerous place and alone. She always has her friends, Margaret and Catherine, to accompany her and help her.
Yes.
And they're not always nice. They get mad at her sometimes when she does. But, you know, it's a beautiful testament to the Christian value of female friendship.
Yes.
That's the way I see it.
Absolutely. Well said.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So go on with Joan's life. So she gets the visions.
She has the visions. She finds the local commander the local French commander in the nearby town. This is a complicated tale because even as the English are invading, there's a civil war going on that her family has felt the effects of. But she is able to get, I think his name is Robert Badricourt, to take her to see the crown prince, Charles, the Dauphin, so she can make the case that she is to lead an army and liberate the town of Orléans. That's why we call her Maid of Orléans.
Yep.
To liberate the town of Orléans and in so doing, do what? Clear the path to Reims or Reims.
Yeah, yeah. Which is where...
All the crown heads of France have been crowned. It is important political gesture that he gets brought there and crowned before the world as King of France. So it has to take place in that cathedral, which is a magnificent cathedral, by the way.
That makes it legitimate.
Favorite in the world.
That would be, I don't know if we would even have an American parallel to the leader is, I mean, we have the inauguration and all that. Like, you're not,
yeah,
I guess
that
you're
has
not.
To take place on the steps of the Capitol or something like that, but it doesn't contain any significance. And here's why.
Yeah.
Because that spot where that cathedral is built, and I tell this in my lecture on St. Joan, is where St. Remy, or Remigius, baptizes Clovis.
Who is the first Christian king of France.
Exactly. Yeah, brought in by his wife, Clotilde.
Yeah, and when you want to think about Clovis, you could think about the period, an analogy might be to, there's no person that analogizes it, but Clovis becoming Christian is like what happened with Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico many years later, that a whole country is Christianized because of an event. And so the Clovis event is the Christianizing of the barbarian place of France.
Yeah, and barbarian is a good word here.
Yeah, in the way that Guadalupe did that for Mexico later.
You know, it's well said, Cy. Clovis wasn't a gentle fellow.
No, there were no gentle fellows then.
No.
Right? That you didn't last long if you were very gentle.
But that's the significance of that spot.
Yeah. So this is right. And
this is exactly what she does. I mean, the campaign is the Loire Valley campaign. And when we do our next river cruise or something, we'll have to go to the Loire Valley.
Yeah.
And but that siege of Orléans is, I mean, it is a moment in the Christian story, but it's a moment in political military history as well.
So tell me about that, because I don't know that part of it. Like that she changes the way cities are attacked from an old model to a new model.
Well, it's a kind of an interesting time in military history where walled cities are beginning to fade as cannons get better and better.
Right.
Now, that isn't something that happens overnight. It's over a period of centuries. But nonetheless, the critical thing is that she arrives at Orléans when the French have really just decided to throw in the towel.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's right. The spirits are completely defeated.
Yeah, but no, but she goes and she saves the city.
And she does this by, we've got to talk about how she does it because it's important. Joan doesn't lead from behind.
No.
That's not Joan of Arc's style. We're having fun talking about Joan of Arc. I really think that Chris and I could do it for 10 hours, but she's worth it. Do you think the story's good so far? Oh, it gets better. And Chris has got a Joan of Arc challenge for you, too.
Coming up.
When we come back right after this on our Memorial Day edition of Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about Joan of Arc this hour. We've been talking about military saints for the duration of this program for Memorial Day, where we give thanks and we memorialize and we remember those who have given their life in the service of this country from before its founding, I suppose, as an independent country, certainly. There were many who served to defend their homeland long before even the revolution, and many continue to do so even today around the world. And we are grateful for them, for their love of country, and for the charity with which they express that love of country.
Sacrifice, Simon, the time away from families, my goodness.
So we're talking about Joan of Arc, who at 13 years old in the year, it would have been 1425, begins to get... visions. The visions have to do with crowning Charles, the King of France, and restoring France to the French people, and liberating it from the English invaders during the Hundred Years' War. And go ahead.
I was going to say, first of all, we have to do our Joan of Arc challenge.
Okay, do the Joan of Arc challenge.
So her feast is coming up. It's Saturday. It's the 30th of May.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not on the liturgical calendar.
Really?
She's in the Martyrology, but in 1969, she was removed from the liturgical calendar.
Everybody got removed in 1969.
Yes.
It was a bad year for Saints. Well, there was a lot of streamlining going on at the time.
Yes. So now she had not actually been on the liturgical calendar that long.
No, she's only a 20th century saint.
Yep.
Yeah.
She can't canonized by Benedict the 15th, right?
Okay. I can't ever remember those things.
So I'm just going to say 1915, 1917. It clearly
having to do with the First World War.
It clearly was a gesture to the French.
Yeah. So
there's two challenges here. One is there a saint that has spent less time on the liturgical calendar than Saint Joan?
So if you can find one.
Yeah, tell me.
Yeah.
Now here's the other one. Is there a saint that has more memorials or statues in the United States or in North America, if you want, on public land?
Oh, really?
Than St. Joan.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the statue of St. Francis that we all have in our garden.
No, right. Okay? But St. Joan is...
I believe that there is no saint in the United States that has more statues on public land. And I can rattle off about six right now.
Let me give you... Okay, go ahead.
Well, I don't know that we need to, but so here's the challenge. If anybody sends me the most, or one, a saint of whom there are more public statues,
yeah,
or a complete list of all the Joan statues in, if you want to do North America and include Quebec and Montreal, that's fine.
Yeah.
I just gave you two.
There'll be some up there.
Yeah. And if there's a saint that spent less time on liturgical calendar, we'll get a free copy of my audio lecture on
that's awesome.
St. Joan.
What an interesting thing. Yeah, she's very late put on. I mean, because there's
send an email to what? What's your radio at?
Radio@catholic.com.
Catholic.com.
Yeah, radio@catholic.com. And a secondary challenge might be, is there another saint responsible for a popular haircut fad in the United States? Because... you remember the flappers?
Yes.
That comes from Joan of Arc. Because there were so many Joan of Arc posters during the First World War.
Right.
That women started to think, oh, that's a great little haircut Joan's got there.
Yeah.
So she also is responsible for the flappers.
All right. That I did not know.
You seem to be dissatisfied by that.
It's not my favorite hairstyle. I like long hair, Sonny.
You anti-flapper.
But I understand why she had to cut her hair short. That makes total sense to me.
Okay, so we were talking about the siege of
Orléans. Right. And
Orleans.
You were saying she led from...
We have a city in America called New Orleans,
right,
named after it.
It's true.
It's newer. That's why they call it New Orleans.
Yeah.
So there's probably some Joan of Arc statues down there.
It's on the Loire River.
And Joan
leads from the front.
She leads from the front. Her banner is the thing that everyone follows. And this is interesting. It's very von Clausewitz kind of thing. Concentration of mass.
Yes.
The entire force follows Joan, and this concentration of mass is actually devastating to the walls of Orleans. I'm just going to say Orleans.
That's fine. There she is climbing the scaling ladders.
But yeah.
She's wounded.
Yeah, she's wounded. But
she had predicted that she would be wounded. Right?
An arrow went through her.
Yep.
I think in the leg, right?
I thought it was the breast.
Oh, that might... Yeah.
Oh.
It's one of the... I think it seems like you would remember which one of those it was, but okay, I'm going to go with yours. She doesn't actually fight, though. She does not take up a sword or a bow and arrow.
She has a sword.
Yeah, right, but it's...
But it's not clear that she actually uses it to kill anyone.
And it's very symbolic, this sword she
it
has.
It is, yes. It's said to have belonged to Charlemagne or something.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And she wiped the rust off and it fell off right away.
But she never kills anybody. She knows she actually doesn't
think
of...
Or maybe Charles Martel. Belonged to Charles Martel.
Oh, is that what it was?
I think so.
She sees herself as kind of the motivator and leader. She doesn't see herself as a soldier.
But she does call herself the chef de guerre, the war leader, the war chief.
Yeah.
Yeah. In her beautiful speech or letter that she sends to the English side, she says, I am the war commander. I am the chef de guerre.
Yeah.
Right? And you need to go back to England.
Yeah, right. She doesn't lack for confidence, really. I mean, this idea that, you know, the girl power now, that everything's got to be about how, you know, these super girls, which I actually think puts a lot of pressure on young girls a lot of the time. But it's not a modern invention. I mean, Joan is no shrinking violet.
No.
So she's successful.
She is.
At Orleans.
She clears the way to, mm-hmm. there are several other battles. Troyes is another one, Pathé, Jargeau. And she clears the way to Reims. And there is coronated, crowned Charles VII in July of that year.
And at which point, Charles is so grateful for her that he takes care of her and protects her and makes sure the English... No, wait a second.
He really is a jerk. but there's a beautiful story there where she's standing next to him at the coronation holding her banner. And someone says to her, why were you standing next to Charles during the coronation holding the banner? Someone's objecting that she's standing there. And she said, well, my banner did all the work. I think that it should have shared in some of the glory.
And it really did. Her banner is...
Yes, it had the fleur-de-lis on it and a picture of Our Lady and Jesus on it, right? Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
You remember details that I'm not that good at remembering, but... okay, so I do think that at this point it's worth saying one of the reasons why Joan is liturgically a complex figure is that in many minds her battle is essentially political and not religious, and I think that makes people, the church authorities particularly, uncomfortable that she's a hard saint to promote because she's not like she's not a Mother Teresa, she's not a universal. You know, everywhere loved saint. She's not loved in England.
No. Maybe now.
Maybe they've gotten over it, but Shakespeare didn't like her.
No, he called her a witch.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, Shakespeare was a propagandist for the Tudor regime.
That was a great way to keep your head attached.
well, for sure. Dearly as I love him. But I mean, Henry V... we all think was just a sweet guy or a heroic character from Kenneth Branagh and then Laurence Olivier, et cetera. I mean, he was a monster.
Yeah.
And Agincourt, however you want to pronounce that, I mean, there are, which takes place, you know, just a few years after Joan is born, there are French noblemen who, according to the customs of the day, are surrendering there on the battlefield and they get their throats slit in complete expectation of being ransomed, captured and ransomed, which was the custom of the day. And then Henry's campaign across Normandy is brutal.
We're moving here.
Back in time. Sorry.
No, but that's okay. But I just want to point out we're moving here with Henry, with the longbows and all of that, from medieval warfare to modern warfare.
Sure.
And it's a less moral form of warfare. There's no question about it.
That absolutely is true.
You could surrender and be very confident that your head is not going to get chopped off in the medieval period. And this is a violation of that.
And that kind of limited warfare does not come back to the page of history until after the 30 Years' War with the Peace of Westphalia, where Europe is just so sick from what has happened.
Yeah.
There is a brief period in the 18th and 19th century where it's...
As an American, the United States contributed a great deal to that too. There was... With the Geneva Conventions, mm-hmm. and the American idea that there should be law in war being promoted, I do think Americans have something to be proud of there.
To be sure, but then when we use expressions like unconditional surrender, we're setting aside that legacy.
Yes, yeah.
But right. Boy, we're getting far afield here. Yeah. So Joan is Joan now is kind of caught up in the court there of Charles VII, and she's trying to raise an army to go take Paris, and he's not on board with the plan.
No.
And then she does something which actually was one of the objections at her canonization. She raises an army herself and goes to take Paris. So, you know, acting independently and without the authority of the crown. And when she was up for canonization, the devil's advocates were saying, well, was this an act of civil disobedience or...
Right. You know, and what do you make of it?
The whole story is just so strange, Si. I'm trying to think of a story where you have God intervening in the political history of a nation like this at this level.
Right.
And there really isn't one. I mean, Our Lady of Guadalupe is, but that's Our Lady. Right?
Yeah. And it's not political at all.
No.
There's no political implications really to Guadalupe.
Well, I mean, it's the overthrow of the Aztec regime. So I guess you could say, well, but really
that preceded that.
Yeah, but it does. But yeah. But what we're trying to do is bring about the Christianization of, yeah. of the new world here. But in the case of, I don't know. It's France is the eldest daughter. Has this special place in the heart of our Lord, perhaps, and certainly in the heart of Our Lady, as Father Hugh likes to point out. She's appeared in France more than any other places Our Lady has.
Or it's just the French brag about it more than other people.
But I think there are more approved Marian apparitions in France than in any other country.
And it makes perfect sense. And
because Our Lady loves French. It's a beautiful language.
So if you come to believe, as I have come to believe, that Joan is an act of God, really, that Joan is that Jesus is actively at work in the life of Joan, sending Michael the Archangel, sending Margaret and Catherine, giving her her mission, and this has to do with history that will unfold 100 and 200 and 300 years after the life of Joan. And we'll take a break and we'll talk. You and I can
I know
debate.
Where you're going.
You think so?
I think so.
All right. So what is this
and
all
I agree
about?
With you.
Why would this happen? Why would God get involved in this little, 100 years war with this girl from Domremy and make this happen? If you come to believe that he did, you got to have some reason why would he do it, right. And we'll do that when we come back.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I do want to say we don't here at Catholic Answers Live prefer France to England. That's not the point.
Is that right? We don't?
Well, I mean, you might prefer.
I think you're going to declare here. You know,
I don't think you can be a Catholic apologist and prefer one country.
I'm technically not an apologist. So
well, you run an apologetics organization.
This is what I'm going to say. In the 1066 contest, I completely side with the Anglo-Saxons.
Wow, good for you. You chose the losing side a millennium late.
What's
good
his
for
name? William the Conqueror? I actually have another name for him. He was the bad guy. Now, he's going to claim that he had the backing of the church on that one, but I totally side with Harold.
But that has nothing to do with England.
Well, it does. That
England
was the
is a place, a people, and a story.
Yes, but it was before the horrible Norman takeover of England, back when it was a beautiful bucolic.
Everybody was a shepherd.
Can I tell you something? When Tolkien is writing about the Shire,
yeah,
he clearly has pre-Norman England in mind. There's no question of it.
Yeah, Tolkien is such a medieval guy that he thinks everything after 1066 is a modern imposition on English purity.
To be sure.
But the English had just defeated the Vikings.
They had under the great...
yeah, okay. Well, we're enough of our English
Alfred,
history.
Alfred the Great.
I love England, and I say this with two Irish grandfathers.
Well, the food is so good.
Don't even start on the English food. But in this case, the English had to be expelled from France.
They were the bad guys.
And I do believe there is a providential reason for this. This is connected to a divine plan.
Yes.
Having to do with Martin Luther.
Yes. And Henry VIII.
Yeah. And right. And Calvin and Zwingli and
yeah.
The whole crowd. And well, Elizabeth II.
Yes, because France is preserved from the errors of the Protestant Rebellion.
Had France been England in the 1500s, which it was not because of Joan of Arc, mm-hmm. That France would have been, you know, a suburb of London, had it not been for Joan of Arc, then the Protestant Reformation would have come to France.
Yeah. And the Protestant Reformation, as Monsignor Philip Hughes, who's the great English historian of the Reformation in England and throughout Europe as well, he makes the point in his short volume on the Reformation. He said, it's because of England that the Reformation spreads all over the world. Because
oh, what a great
the Protestantism, I should say, spreads all over, that the errors of Protestantism spread all over the world. Because England evolves into an empire almost as great as Spain. And
right.
So, you know, third in the world behind Rome, Spain, England, I guess you could say.
Rome's, but okay.
Yeah. So it just in imperial history. But yeah, it's because of England that Protestantism spreads its errors all over the globe into the New World.
But the thing is, though, look at the New World. Most of it is Catholic. And it is now, even today, the heartland of the Catholic world. If you said, where is the exact epicenter of the Catholic world? It's probably somewhere in Colombia.
Brazil.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it? Right. I think Brazil is the largest Catholic country in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, someone listening say these aren't Catholic countries, or I mean the expression of the faith there.
Yeah, they are. They're Catholic countries who are suffering through the modern confusion, just like everybody else.
Right.
But they're Catholic countries.
Right. Right. They are. Their founding is Catholic.
Sure.
Which is not something that we can say for our country.
No, that's right. We don't have a Catholic personality. We don't have this is a primarily Protestant country with a Protestant ethic and a
and periods of anti-Catholicism.
Sure.
Significant ones.
Right.
Yeah.
So the thing about France, however, is when you think of the Catholic Reformation that follows the Protestant rebellion in the North, it's impossible for that to have the space it needs to do what it does. Like, you can't think of people, even, you know, the great Spaniards like Loyola and Teresa of Avila and even the Italians like Philip Neri, and how could they have done what they done had France not been this great bulwark, this enormous Catholic power there sitting between Southern Europe and the Christian rebellion in the North?
Yes. No, I completely agree with you. Now, when France does go off the rails, boy, does she.
Yeah, but it's much, much later. Yes. I mean, Columbus sailing is in 1492 to what ends up being the discovery of the New World is in a sense a protected event, because Portugal and Spain and Italy are all protected by France sitting on top of them.
In fact, I would argue that had it not been for the Inquisition in Spain and the homogeneity, the religious homogeneity of the Iberian Peninsula, that the discovery of the New World could not have taken place.
So in a sense, what you could say is a great and very vibrant, wealthy, in fact, and intellectually powerful Catholic culture is preserved all across Southern Europe because France, under Joan of Arc, is maintained as France. And
yes.
And all of that, I mean, you just think of the intellectual power, the contributions that are being made in places like Salamanca during this time, and all throughout Italy. You think of the great age of discovery and exploration. These are all products of Catholic Southern Europe.
Yes.
And then you come to the Americas, and now we have, I don't know, a billion Christians in the Americas, a billion Catholics, because I'm just guessing at the number.
No, it's true, because Spain doubles the size of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Right, in 1492.
Yeah.
So I say that because I think you need some kind of context for Joan. Well, what is all this about?
And you have made it global.
I do believe it is, though.
I mean, agree with you.
I mean, that's the way God operates. 13-year-old girls really matter in the plan of God.
Sure.
They are not superfluous extra accoutrement. Look at that French.
Yeah.
The 13-year-old girls, like in the person of Our Lady and the person of people like Joan, really, really matter. And the things that they do really matter as far as having global historical impacts.
I agree. It's it's just such a magnificent story.
It is.
So, Cy, what are the books that you like? What are the if you had
I would recommend Mark Twain's
I like
novel.
Twain's very much
because it, I mean, I guess novels are maybe easier for me to read than history. I don't know.
Well, you and I are English majors. I think you do, I think you get deeper into the human condition when you have some when you have the liberties that fiction grants.
I'll tell you what. If I could say again, just go read the transcripts of the trial yourself. It's not a boring old transcript. I would say everybody that wants to know, wants to meet Joan personally in a way. Like, this is a very strange thing that you have this medieval saint whose word for word utterances are recorded because yes. That's how the courts worked, word for word. This is a legal transcript. And the thing she says, and I want to mention one thing she says because it's maybe just the most perfect Christian witness ever. Well, they're trying to get Joan. They're trying to get a charge of heresy against Joan. And before we leave, I also want to talk about her dressing like a man because that's the thing that people are interested in. But and they say, "Are you in a state of grace, or do you know whether you are in a state of grace?"
Yes.
And Joan doesn't answer the question with anything except a prayer.
Right.
She says, "If I am, may God keep me there, and if I am not, may He restore me."
Right.
And that's a paraphrase, but this is such a perfect, this is a Christ-like answer of who do you serve, you know, should I pay the tax to Caesar?
Right.
Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's?
Yes,
render.
Well said.
Like, it's that perfect that you see the people trying to trap her utterly dumbfounded.
Right.
Because she's Joan. I don't know how else.
And doubtless it just infuriated the French bishops who were basically puppets of the English regime in wanting her dead.
Yeah. All right. Well, what would you recommend?
I like Hilaire Belloc's.
Oh, how great.
Yeah. And I love the Twain as well. Belloc's is
more Catholic. I mean,
it is, and it's shorter. So if you're just going to pick one thing up and you just want to read something fairly quickly in a couple of days,
yeah,
I would recommend Belloc's.
All right.
If you want to read something long and quite accurate, but from a very unexpected source, I recommend the Vita Sackville West.
I don't know it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'll just say this, not exactly a person who you would think would have written a really good, accurate history of Joan.
That's another thing about Joan. She's so appealing
yes.
to the modern audience. She just does. She has this strange appeal. All right, dressing like a boy, dressing like a man.
Which she does, by the way, from the very first, just even when she leaves Domremy to get to Chinon to see the, because she's going in disguise.
Not just that. Wearing pants protects her in the way wearing a dress does not.
Right. And no, it's to preserve her chastity.
She is bound in these pants. Like, she will not remove them, you know, to put on a dress, even for in prison. In those days, a woman in prison has the right to be cared for by women. There should be no men in a woman's prison.
Right.
It's illegal for there to be men in a women's prison.
She was denied every right. She was denied right of counsel.
Yeah. She's imprisoned in a men's prison guarded by men. That's right. Why Joan's wearing pants. That's why right. She's not wearing a dress. If you right. want to, it's got nothing to do with modern, you know, and God bless them. I'm not trying to hate on anybody, but it's got nothing to do with modern queer theory.
No.
It's got nothing to do with Joan. This is a sign of the intense bravery of this girl. She knows exactly what she's dealing with.
There's a line in Chesterton where he says, I'm going to get this 80%. He says, a woman like Joan, who knew why women should not wear pants, was absolutely justified in wearing them.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And here's the trick. If she had changed and put on a dress and then gone back to wearing pants, she's guilty of heresy because of a technicality of the law.
Right.
That if you correct a behavior and then go back to that behavior, you can be killed for heresy. You're allowed, in other words, to correct your behavior once. That's why she never would do it. Because even if just once she did it, then in court, they could have said, well, you reformed, and then you abandoned the reform a second time, and now you deserve a sentence of death. The sentence of death, by the way, was nullified by the Pope about 20 years after her death. So she no longer is under any cloud of the penalties that were assigned to her. She was not guilty.
I visited the spot in Rouen.
Where she was burned?
Yes. Yeah.
Three times she was burned. Joan of Arc, pray for us.
Amen.
Chris Check, thank you very much.
Really God bless you, Si. It's been a great couple hours.
Yeah, yeah. And God bless everybody on this Memorial Day. We'll pray for continued healing and renewed prosperity for everyone around the world.
Raise a glass to fallen comrades.
Yes, please do. And commend them to the intercession of Joan of Arc. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.